You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Paradise Bound, a posthumous new story collection and memoir by Lucia Berlin, the once overlooked storyteller turned literary sensation, offer snapshots of a life fully lived by Keziah Weir. Illustrations by Cassandra Motoreal. In the airport, Berlin writes, women wore fur coats and their dogs wore fur coats. In this illustration, we see women inside the airport walking their dogs. The women are wearing fur coats, of course. Next illustration, he was married to a wealthy older woman who kept him on a loose rein. And here we see a man at a party, and he is roving around looking at women. And next illustration, bougainvillea and hibiscus, canna lilies, 4 o'clocks, impatiens and zinnia. And that makes for a very beautiful garden, and it happens to be near the seaside. When you travel, you step back from your own days, from the fragmented, imperfect linearity of your time, writes Lucia Berlin in her second posthumous story collection, Evening in Paradise, published this month by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. As when reading a novel, the events and people become allegorical and eternal. The surreal feeling Berlin describes, the sense that time moves slower when one is in a new place, and that images take on new meaning, has a basis in science. The brain takes longer to process the unknown, visiting a foreign city, for example, than it does information that's previously been banked, a day at the office, or watching Game of Thrones reruns. While new experiences seem to pass quickly in the moment, in retrospect, they seem unusually drawn out. As a writer, Berlin, who died in 2004 on her 68th birthday and received widespread renown in only 2015 with the posthumous release of A Manual for Cleaning Women, embodies this phenomenon, maybe because her fiction, much of which is autobiographical, exudes such a strong sense of place. Along with the collection, FSG is releasing Welcome Home, a memoir with selected photographs and letters, which she was writing at the time of her death, and which introduces the reader to the settings and figures in her life that become the backbone of her fiction. Born in Alaska to a mining engineer father and a mother with a crippling drinking problem that Berlin would inherit, she grew up in El Paso, Texas, and Santiago, Chile, and later made homes in such varied locales as Albuquerque, New Mexico, downtown Manhattan, Northern California's East Bay, and a handful of cities across Mexico. Like all of Berlin's writing, the stories in Evening in Paradise are highly visual. In one, she describes little dogs in the Miami airport with hair dyed peach to match the women's hair. In New York, the fruit and vegetable markets open out onto the streets, wild banners of lemons, plums, tangerines. In Chile, before a race car driver's funeral, the dead boy's mother was saying that it would be the death of her, but in fact, she was very lively, making tea and passing scones and answering the telephone. These quietly cinematic moments permeate the collection, so it's fitting that the title story takes place around a film set, John Huston's The Night of the Iguana, 1964, adapted from the Tennessee Williams play and shot on location around Puerto Vallarta, where Berlin was living at the time. The story, which homes in on the film's real-life Hollywood cast and the town residents, is told from the point of view of a hotel bartender, Hernan, who watches a boozy night unfold. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton are in the early days of their turbulent love affair. Ava Gardner is obsessed with one of the local men. A fight breaks out, then resolves. The final words in the story are Hernan's, as the last straggler heads home. Hasta mañana, he says. See you tomorrow. This is quintessential Berlin, and it's why reading her in today's frenzied doomsday newsflash feels like a vacation, a breath of fresh air. Despite the chatter and chaos, there is the promise of change tomorrow, be it good or bad. Or if it's consistency we seek, her words, steeped in time, offer that as well. The boy whistles on a wall in Mexico, Berlin writes. Tess leans her head against a cow. They will keep doing that forever. The sun will just keep on falling into the sea. Keziah Weir writes on accoutrement, "When it comes to earrings, more is more. The Gilded Age." They just piled up, artist Doreen Garner says of her array of piercings, which total 11 across both ears and varyingly showcase delicate sets of hoops, heavy gold studs, and dangling sculptural pieces. And she's pictured here in a photograph by Mamadi Doumbouya, styled by Alexis Cantor, and she has a couple of nose piercings and various earlobe and cartilage piercings. Garner, whose first job was working at the front desk of a Philadelphia piercing shop, has long embraced what she calls a more is better approach to such ornamentation. Now, style arbiters from Rihanna to Zoe Kravitz have solidified multiple piercings as a lasting red carpet look, and celebrity piercers and jewelers like J. Colby Smith offer bedecked Instagram feeds of inspiration. In her visceral work as a sculptor, Garner interrogates the medical industry's exploitation of black bodies. Her 2017 show, Purge, at Pioneer Works in Brooklyn, exposed the damage done by the 19th century doctor J. Marion Sims. Garner is interested in the interplay between pain and power, she says. Her piercings, which she describes as a form of self-ownership and adornment, play a part in that conversation, and aesthetically, layering her preferred brass and rose and yellow gold pieces, or the bejeweled collection seen here, allows for maximalism on a micro scale. Rather than choose which statement pieces to wear, she says, I stack them all. Now, on to beauty. High note. Beauty favorites from Georgia Smith, the British-born crooner whose affecting debut album, Lost and Found, spans trip-hop and R&B. For lips, NARS Velvet Matte Lip Pencils in Mysterious Red and Dolce Vita. Face wash, Elemis Superfood. In my carry-on, Fenty Gloss Balm, Nivea Cream, The Body Shop Vitamin E Refreshing Eyes Cube, Dr. Jart Plus Face Mask. For dramatic eyes, Anastasia Beverly Hills Soft Glam, and loads of Dior Show Iconic Overcurl Mascara. To take it off, Bioderma Sensibio Micellar Water. For brows, Threaded at Slash Beauty on Portobello Road. Desert Island product, La Mer, the lip balm. Exfoliant, Nip and Fab Glycolic Fix Daily Cleansing Body in Daily Cleansing Pads. Oil, Malin and Goetz Recovery Treatment Oil. At Home Face Mask, Charlotte Tilbury Goddess Skin Clay Mask. For hair, my hairstylist, Zatisha Barber, she's the best. Home smells like DW Home Candle in Plum and Bordeaux Fig and Palo Santo Body. For a sore throat, the herbal cough medicine Ninjom Pe Pa Kwa. Massage, Cowshed Spas. Best foundation, MAC Studio Face and Body in C5. In the shower, This Works Deep Sleep Shower Gel. In the bath, Aromatherapy Associates Deep Relax Bath and Shower Oil. Best beauty advice, my makeup artist, Carol, says always take your makeup off every night. To wake up, green tea from Mariage Frere. Manicure, pinky nude shades with glitter, pointed, not too long. A great workout, my trainer, Faisal, or Barry's Boot Camp. Ideal snack food, oranges and kettle chips. Favorite meal, Mom's cooking, lasagna, or salmon pasta. Post-show food, depends what's on the rider. Post-show drink, rosé champagne. Fragrance, Malin and Goetz Dark Rum. rebel force. Why wouldn't a music genre that reflects real stories not move with the times, says singer-songwriter Kacey Musgraves about the controversy over some of her early country songs. One of the most outspoken voices to come out of Nashville in years, Musgraves is the only female nominated for Best Album at this year's Country Music Awards and is poised to compete for Pop and Country Grammys in February. Here she talks about her reputation, how country music treats women, and her hair, by Lisa Robinson. Photo illustration of Kacey Musgraves by Braulio Amado. You went to Nashville to pursue a recording career when you were only 19. Were you scared? When I left my hometown, Golden, Texas, I went to Austin first, figured out how to live on my own, write songs, do my own shows. So when I got to Nashville, I jumped right in. I didn't have a backup plan. I was super fearless. On your debut album, Same Trailer, Different Park, you wrote about gay rights, drugs, and cast a cynical eye on small-town life. Was that really considered controversial? I have gotten that rebel or outlaw card, and I think partly it's because I'm a woman. But it's pretty inaccurate if you look at the roots of country music storytelling. These are just songs about real shit. I'm carrying on a tradition of songwriters I admire, like Willie Nelson, Hank Williams, and Emmylou Harris. Is country radio still important? And is it true that women are encouraged to flirt with radio programmers? Grammys, critical acclaim, even the quality of the music. Nothing matters except how much radio play you're getting. No one's specifically said, you've got to sit on this guy's lap. I probably would slap them in their face if they told me that. It's more like implied expectations. A program director got really mad at me because I wasn't paying enough attention to him, so he canceled a radio dinner I was supposed to have. I mean, can we just talk about the music? And men are treated differently. Look at award shows when they pan to the loser. A woman has to smile, but if a man has his tough face on, they don't call him a bitch. There are indications that it's moving forward, but I have not seen any hard proof yet. Did you really meet your husband, Rustin Kelly, when you went to a songwriter's night in 2016 at Nashville's Bluebird Cafe? Yes, I don't usually go out alone, but I had cleared my schedule, my hair looked good, and I just figured I'll go. Rustin was playing, his back was to me the whole time, and his songs really got to me. I was like, who is this guy? I really like his brain. So I went up to him afterwards and said we should write together. A few months later, we had a writing date, and it sounds cliche, but we had an instant connection, and we've been inseparable ever since. Did being in love contribute to the optimistic songs on your new album, Golden Hour? I used to justify my terrible relationships, thinking I could get good songs out of them. But what kind of personal torture is that? When I met Rustin, I was like, F, now that I'm happy, I'm not going to be able to be creative. But the opposite happened. I got inspired by it. You've said you use a lot of hairspray, but you don't have that big Tammy Wynette country hair. I used to have that big-ass Texas hair, and it's still pretty flat, so I have to tease that shit like crazy. On your tour, you do your own hair and makeup. Are you going to do that for the Grammys? Hell no. I don't trust myself in a TV scenario. On Fashion, Under Wraps, one of the world's best-dressed bags is getting a new outfit. Photographed by Kiernan Monahan and Theo Vamvonakis. An Hermes Birkin 30 bag in crocodile leather. Jane Birkin recently mused that what people most associate her with may not be her roles in films like Antonioni's Blow Up, 1966, or her decades-long music career, but rather her iconic Hermes namesake. Well, she said cheerfully, it could be worse. Now, upon the 35th anniversary of the Birkin bag, one of the house's creative directors, Bally Barrett, has given the ultimate status accessory an accessory of its own, a canvas cover, available in three different colors. Now you and your deeply luxurious, discerningly practical wardrobe will sing in the rain. New York, je t'aime. On the eve of Chanel's first New York show in more than a decade, the Roving Métier d'Art collection, Karl Lagerfeld takes us through his city must-sees. Hotel, the Mercer, because it is like being at home. New York neighborhood, everything around the Mercer. Can't miss the Guggenheim Building. Current muse, Lily Rose Depp. Place to be alone. Nobody goes to New York to be alone. Place to be seen. I'm seen wherever I go. Bookstore, Strand. Store to purchase gifts, à la vieille Russie. Favorite travel companion, Choupette. Classic New York movie, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Café, we're not in Paris, but I like the Russian tea room. For a post-show celebration, Central Park. Art gallery, Pace. Artist, Jeff Koons. To be outdoors, Gramercy Park. Architecture, the Chrysler Building. Flower shop, I have my flowers shipped from Paris. Brooklyn or Manhattan? They are so different, I cannot say that I prefer one to the other. It's like comparing Paris to Nuit. I like both. Red eye or day flight? Private jet, day flight. Museum, the Met, because you have everything there. New York in three words. New York, New York, New York, like the song. onto the fairground. Power after hours. Movers and makers took a break from disruption during the evening festivities at Vanity Fair's New Establishment Summit in L.A. by H.W. Vail. Photographs by Justin Bishop. In the photos, Richard Plepler with John Sykes and Julia Boorstin. Jason Blum hosted Titans of Tech, Hollywood, and Wall Street at his Hancock Park home. B.J. Novak, Katie Couric, Adam Chiralski, Jason Blum, and Brooks Barnes. Manish Goyal and Monica Lewinsky. Juliette de Bobigny. Images were captured on a Google Pixel 3. Shea Blum, Couric, jokes. Lewinsky flashes a smile. Cheers to new faces. Kickoff cocktails were held at the home of Jason Blum, the producer behind Paranormal Activity and Get Out. Inside, guests mingled among life-size replicas of characters from Blum's horror hits. During her conversation with Hannah Gadsby on the summit stage, Monica Lewinsky told the comedian that when she saw her in Nanette, "I have never gone to a stand-up comedy show and bawled my eyes out as much as I did." And she quipped, "Given my history, that was pretty surprising." Table It, Creative Time, the public arts organization, transformed a Brooklyn warehouse into an art world dreamscape for its annual gala. Photographs by Landon Nordeman. Guest seated at dinner, which was followed by a fiesta cum discotheque after party down the street. Annabelle Dexter Jones. The gala honored the Mexican artist Pedro Reyes and toasted the organization's new director, Justine Ludwig. "Creative time is based on two simple principles," Ludwig said. "Art should be accessible to the public, and artist voices should play an integral part in shaping our society." Reagan Grusi, Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at the New Museum, speaks with Duke Riley, Creative Time artist. Philip Ahrens, Millennium Partners co-founder and Creative Time board member. Artist Anders Bergstrom and Yamini Nayar. Yolanda Santos, philanthropist and art collector, speaks with gala honoree Pedro Reyes. Pamela Echeverria, Labor Gallery founder and artist Javier Tellez. Jeannie Freilich, Lisson Gallery director, and Sam Reck, artist and Nan Golden studio manager. Shelley Fox Ahrens, philanthropist and art collector. And David Velasco, Art Forum editor-in-chief. All pictured here. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections from Vienna Gold. Waltzes, marches, and polkas. A tribute to Johann Strauss. The London Festival Orchestra, conducted by Eric Rogers.